This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Last year at this time, the late Joe Paterno was an iconic college football coach at Penn State University, a man who had a job for as long as he wanted. By the end of the year, he'd been fired, his 46-year legacy tarnished by a child abuse scandal.
If it's going to call attention to something that generates so much money for the university, like a prestigious football program, the tendency, unfortunately, is to protect the golden goose.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear from the author of a new book on the continuing fallout of that scandal. We'll also hear from a sports doctor about why more attention is being given to concussions in school sports and some steps being taken to treat and perhaps prevent the problem. And we'll spend an academic minute talking about Big Mo. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Hard to believe it's been only 6 months since the child sex abuse charges broke against the longtime coach at Penn State University, and the conspiracy of silence about the allegations, both past and present, came to light and rocked Division I college sports. The shocking story started to pour out after the arrest last November of Jerry Sandusky, who for 32 years had been a top assistant coach to legendary football coach Joe Paterno. It turns out Paterno was told about an incident where Sandusky was found showering with an underage boy in a football locker room, but reported the incident to school officials rather than the police. The story is told in the new book, Game Over, Jerry Sandusky, Penn State, and the Culture of Silence. The best of our knowledge is Joe Donahue spoke with the co-author of the book, Bob Dvorchik, and asked what brought him to write this book so early and what will doubtless be a continuing story.
It's a necessary story to tell, even though it's so painful and heartbreaking to get back into. The story has so many layers. Some of the reporting has been Pulitzer Prize winning, but it comes out piecemeal. What we wanted to do was to tell it from the start and put it in context along with our own new information and tell a story from start to finish going into the trial, which is scheduled for mid-June.
When you look at this, to me, the most fascinating thing about the book is, and as you indicate in the subtitle of the book, which is Jerry Sandusky, Penn State, and the Culture of Silence, is that culture of silence. And I'm hoping you can address that a little bit of how that culture came to be, and is it something that is rare or is common in such a collegiate setting?
I think one of the things you take away from Game Over, it's a cautionary tale that every college administrator in this country should read, and anybody who runs an institution should be aware of. One thing you take away also is how isolated Penn State is, geographically in the middle of a valley, in the middle of the state, in the middle of nowhere. Isolation is one of its charms, but it's also one of the main contributors to what happened. It wasn't just geography. There's this cultural mentality of, say, Happy Valley. Now, I don't think it's particularly a Penn State issue. I think it's many people ought to be doing some self-examination now. I'll give you one example. I was in central Pennsylvania in 1979 when the Three Mile Island accident happened. And the utility is saying one thing about, well, this is all under control and there's no problem. And 2 days later, they're evacuating women and children. So this is a meltdown of a different sort.
But again, that culture of silence, of having a horrible thing happen to multiple people, and for various reasons, for the victims, for the victims' families, for those who found out about it, to Coach Paterno, to college officials, of all keeping this silence, you see the whole thing start to build and realize that a lot of it could have ended years ago had someone said something.
There were so many missed opportunities here, which is one of the most heartbreaking and painful aspects of it. And perhaps it starts with when you're originally told that there's an incident occurred and you just don't want to believe it. And you say, well, that couldn't have happened to someone who's so considered a pillar of the community. And if you don't believe it, then, you know, you want to avoid it, then you get into denial. And then if you do confront it and to correct the problem, you have to admit you have one. But then again, if it's going to call attention to something that generates so much money for the university, like a prestigious football program, the tendency, unfortunately, is to protect the golden goose rather than to protect the outsiders.
And certainly, and I just want to clarify what I was saying earlier, I am by no means talking about the victims here. So, and certainly understanding their concern and how they have been traumatized by what has happened. But really, this stems back as early as the late 1990s, correct?
Correct. First investigation by the Penn State Campus Police was in 1998 when an irate mother wanted to have Sandusky arrested because her 11-year-old son said he had showered naked with Jerry Sandusky in the Penn State football locker room.
And what you get in the first part of the book is the college's attempt to basically get him to stop showering with young boys at Penn State. That was sort of their answer to that, right?
Or to, after the second incident is reported, is to say, don't bring any more boys on campus. Keep it out of here. Don't bring that problem here because we don't want to have to deal with it. You know, April happens to be Child Abuse Prevention Month and Sexual Assault Awareness Month. These kinds of things happen in a culture of shame and silence. And maybe we ought to be looking at the warning signs ahead of time. If this calls attention to that issue, well, then I think for the better.
When you look at the, you know, the fact that it went back to 1998 and the school said, okay, don't do this again, how much, because you get the sense that they just turned a blind eye away. I mean, they even though reports were still coming in, they weren't doing anything.
Correct. It was, and it goes back to that issue. First of all, I can't believe this could have happened. It involves this guy. So I'll go to the 2002 incident where there's an independent witness, a graduate assistant coach, who witnesses something, and Penn State looks into it. But nobody contacted the 10-year-old boy to find out who he was or get his version of events. It was almost as if he were invisible.
With the trial beginning soon and, of course, innocent until proven guilty, obviously this will have a long-term impact on sports and certainly on Penn State. Do you think the lessons that can be learned are being learned here?
What we've seen from Penn State is a promise to be more transparent in how it deals with the outside world, that to open up and to encourage its own people, its own employees, not to be afraid to come forward if they see something untoward. If they're truly committed to that and there is this new era of transparency, yes, there are painful lessons, no doubt, but lessons that could create a much healthier environment. That remains to be seen. I mean, this wound is so deep that it's going to take a long time, I think, for it to heal. But an institution isn't an administration, and it's not a football program. Its soul is the mission to educate young people to go out into the world and be successful.
Again, Bob Dvorchak is the co-author of Game Over, Jerry Sandusky, Penn State, and the Culture of Silence. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Joe Donahue. Still to come, some on-the-field problems are getting attention in school sports and the pros. We'll explain next on the best of our knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a tape or CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for the best of our knowledge, number 1129. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. A lot more attention is being paid to athletes who suffer concussions. The problem seems to be growing in both professional and school sports. Dr. Hamish Kerr specializes in sports medicine and exercise physiology for children, teens, and adults at Albany Medical Center in Albany, New York. I recently asked him if there were more concussions in school sports or if we're just getting better at identifying them.
That's a good point, Bob. Really, the thing with concussions is they are being identified more frequently, probably because we're recognizing concussions better than we used to. In the past, concussions were kind of graded on a scale from mild to severe, and we've thrown that approach out the window, really. Any concussion can be severe, and you don't really know how severe until it plays out. So the fact that we're really documenting even these previously ascertained as mild concussions now means that the incidence being reported of concussions is probably increased.
There was a time when nobody was even thought to have had a concussion unless they lost consciousness. Now that's no longer fact, right?
That's absolutely true. The parameters used to document the severity of concussion used to include loss of consciousness and amnesia before and after the event. And we certainly continue to ask about those kind of symptoms, but we don't try and diagnose concussions based on the symptoms or their absence. And certainly you can have a concussion without losing consciousness.
Even with the best of equipment, it's really tough to guard against one of these. I mean, if you have impact, you have impact.
Yeah, that's true. That's an excellent point, in fact. The pathophysiology of concussions is really the brain is shaken, and it's the acceleration of the brain cells that allows the concussion symptoms. And you can either have a direct hit to the head or you can have a indirect hit to a body, and the brain can be shaken either way. So what we find is that even if players are helmeted in sports such as hockey or football, they can still have concussions. In fact, helmets in sports are not designed to prevent concussions. They're designed to prevent skull fractures and intracranial hemorrhage or bleeding in the brain. And they do not protect against concussions. And there really is no evidence of that in any sport. The best evidence for helmets is in bicycle accidents. And in bicycle accidents, helmets have been shown to decrease the incidence of skull fractures and bleeding. But again, it's not designed to prevent concussion.
One thing you mentioned there I'd like to bring up again is that it does not have to be a hit to the head to cause a concussion.
That's very true. I mean, we see events where people are knocked to the ground and they just take a hard fall and may not even injure their head directly. They just land on another body part, and the transferred energy to the brain shakes the brain cells sufficiently to cause a concussion. And it's important to be aware of that if you're a parent or a coach and you're watching games. You know, it can sometimes be a kid who's just doesn't look right after a hard fall rather than necessarily a direct impact to their head.
Well, there are many more body parts involved in sports than the head. Parents have a lot to worry about already. When a kid is going into sports for the first time, how should they be prepared? I'm sure coaches are going to do this. What do the coaches do to prepare a kid for their, say, their first season playing a sport?
Well, I think, first of all, we need to recognize that participating in physical activity and sport is something that we want to encourage, and it's really important that we're all physically active somehow. Organized sports have their risks, but in general, these risks are outweighed by the benefits of performing physical activity and being involved in a team. I think some awareness of the potential problems is important, and that's one of the goals when we perform pre-participation physical exams. As physicians, we try and highlight areas of concern. And that's one avenue of really having an opportunity to educate child athletes and parents what to expect when they begin participation in a sport. Now, each individual sport has its own risks and problems. And certainly for sports such as football, where there's a high level of contact, it's important that there's an awareness of the fact that contact is going to be experienced and that children are physically ready for that. Skeletal maturity becomes important, and height and weight, and obviously you want to avoid a mismatch between a younger, less mature child and an older, mature child potentially tackling each other on the football field.
Are there advances in, say, stretching and exercise that gets kids more prepared than they have been in the past?
I believe that rather than advancing the technique of warm-up and stretching, I think we've really improved the education of everyone in the regard to doing some stretch and warm-up before physical activity. I think that's pretty universal that even the youngest age groups are being coached to warm up and stretch before activity. There's really no good evidence that stretching is of benefit in preventing injury, but it's something that we do, and it's certainly something I do personally. I feel it's of benefit, even if there isn't necessarily the research to support that. Warming up is generally a good idea before any kind of vigorous activity, just getting your body prepared for the activity and kind of getting your head prepared for being involved in something.
Girls are, of course, catching up with boys in participation in sports. Are they also catching up in the trainer's room in the injury department?
Yeah, I think we're seeing an increased incidence of athletic injuries in girls and women, and some of that is related to increased participation levels. But even when you take the increased participation of women and girls into account, there does appear to be some higher incidence of certain injuries in women's sports. The injury that's got the most attention recently, I think, has been anterior cruciate ligament tears, or ACL tears, and there's been somewhat of a number of injuries identified in recent years of ACL injuries in young women.
I was just going to ask you about the ACL. It just seems to be just that one ligament really gives them problems.
Yeah, and there are many thoughts to why that may be the case. I attended a outstanding lecture by a orthopedic surgeon called Mary Lloyd Ireland, who addressed the sports medicine community at a meeting. And it really is remarkable the amount of research that's going on in this regard currently. There are many theories to why women are more at risk. I think the leading theory really is to do with neuromuscular control and landing from jumps and changing direction at the knee. Males are thought to have some perhaps better coordination in landing from jumping than women are, and this is thought to put anterior cruciate ligament tears a higher risk for women athletes. And so there are programs out there to decrease the incidence of ACL tears, really focusing on things like landing with a flexed or bent knee, and improving strength and coordination in quadriceps and hamstring muscles in the legs.
Well, regardless of all the risks, and you made the point earlier that it's with the childhood obesity epidemic that we have now, any participation in any sports has got to way outweigh the risks.
I completely agree with that. In fact, there was a very good article that I read, in one of the local papers, that it was talking about risk in sports and the change that we've kind of seen over the years in what we perceive as risk for sports. I think it was the Wall Street Journal, in fact. It was really sort of saying that, we look closely at things like risk and injury incidents and so forth now. And in the past, participation in sport has really sort of acknowledged that there are risks and got on with it. And we're at a point in our history at this time where we're kind of concerned and almost over concerned about the risks of injury, and I think it is important to highlight that participation has so many benefits, and we have to accept this risk. I mean, there are risks in everything that we do in life, and Sport is in general a very positive experience and can be very rewarding for children for so many reasons that at the end of the day, it's important to be aware of injury risk, but participation is more important than the theoretical risk of injury, in my opinion.
Dr. Hamish Kerr specializes in sports medicine and exercise physiology for children, teens, and adults at Albany Medical Center in Albany, New York. Sports announcers like to talk about how a team has momentum going into a game and changes in momentum during a game. But is that real or just something to fill up airtime? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute. And a quick note, this Academic Minute originally ran in March, but it fit the feel of today's show, so we're going to run it today anyway.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. As we enter the NCAA's March Madness, we will inevitably hear about a player or team's momentum during a game. Professor Kevin Burke of Towson University discusses whether momentum in sports is an illusory or real phenomenon.
It is almost impossible to watch sporting events without hearing athletes, coaches, or spectators speaking of momentum, often citing it as the key to victory. Since the 1980s, researchers have attempted to investigate the concept of momentum. Momentum has been explored in activities such as pitching horseshoes, picking stocks, as well as in basketball, baseball, football, volleyball, tennis, wrestling, ice hockey, billiards, and racquetball. Results of these studies have been inconsistent at best and sometimes frustrating to researchers. Similar but diverse definitions have been used in a variety of research studies, only helping to make difficult the understanding of the precursors to momentum. If scientists, or coaches and athletes, can pinpoint the preceding events of momentum sequences, for example, a steal, good pass, and made three-point shot in basketball, then momentum would have a higher chance of being caused and therefore predictable. Also, no theoretical model has consistently served as a framework for exploring this elusive concept. Momentum has also been studied from the athletes' and spectators' points of view with little consideration for how momentum might be experienced differently from these perspectives. However, it is likely that experiencing sport from the inside versus observing from the outside might be different. When teams or individuals experience positive changes in performance, they are considered to have momentum. Yet these participants often cite momentum caused the improved results. Therefore, circular reasoning has caused misunderstanding of this phenomena. Future research should consider momentum may be a psychological force that is perceived but cannot be measured scientifically. Also, it is possible athletes experience feelings of momentum that do not translate into performance differences noticeable by others. Finally, momentum may simply be a label utilized to describe past successful performance sequences. In other words, momentum may not be caused, but only cited as an after-the-facts explanation.
That was Towson University's Kevin Burke.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.